Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome once again to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and I'm joined as usual by my colleague Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm very well, David. How are you doing today?
Well, not too bad. I should tell our listeners that we're recording this on the evening of Tuesday, the 18th of August. We usually record on a Wednesday, and this probably won't be broadcast until Wednesday, the 19th. So if something earth-shattering happens overnight, I'm afraid we're probably going to be hopelessly out of date by the time our listeners hear this. But I think we've got plenty to talk about. Anyway, it's there won't be anything earth-shattering, I'm sure, except maybe the weather. The weather has been earth-soggying, hasn't it?
we've had a lot of it. You down in Devon have had more than we in Kent. I have neighbours on the other side of town saying that they're drowning, and I'm saying, well, bring it here. It just seems to be missing us all the time. We've had one 10-minute downpour in the past week.
You are joking.
The forecast has said constantly it's like 50% chance of a torrent all the time. And it just never happens. It's always the...
Well, it's like tossing a coin. You can't, you know, you don't know which side it's going to come down on. Yeah, somebody's done studies on that. We've had a lot of rain down here, actually, in my local town, Barnstaple. The centre of Barnstaple was flooded. I saw a picture of somebody rowing around Boutport Street in a dinghy. It certainly was very heavy. Oh, really?
I didn't... Isn't the papers or the BBC website or somewhere, national news.
Oh, right, okay. Well, it must be true then. Really bizarre. And a Spitfire flew over the house just a couple of hours ago, which was also rather strange, but nothing to do with the weather. Yeah, so once again, we get extreme weather situations cropping up. It seemed to happen with surprising regularity now.
Well, we always, at this time of year, we always have stories of either droughts or floods. And of course, the last really bad floods we had was where the dam burst in Derbyshire, which was just before lockdown. We mentioned this
in
the early days of this podcast, of how everyone had forgotten about these poor people who had been flooded out of their houses and then had to go into lockdown. And they sort of, at least on the national news media, seemed to sort of disappear from thought and sight.
That's true. Well, I mean, I noticed normally that this time of year, of course, is known as a silly season where everybody goes on holiday normally under normal circumstances, and no news is generated, and so the national press is reduced to running silly season stories which they wouldn't normally give any attention to. I don't know if you must get more or less the same press releases as me, but this is usually the time of year when I get a plethora of press releases all about white van man. And somebody does a survey. It's usually a van leasing company or somebody like that. They do a survey about how 80% of householders would employ a sole trader to do this, that and the other. And it's actually a plug for a van leasing firm. And another thing I get a lot of this time of year is press releases about make sure that you use plenty of sun cream when you go outside working on site, because, you know, the classic builders stripped to the waist and prancing around on scaffolding getting frazzled and at risk of skin cancer.
But sometimes they're from the HSE and therefore you think take it seriously. And other times it's from Amber Soler or whoever makes sun cream.
That's right. Yes, it is. Well, they'd be very brave if they tried that on now with all this rain. And I don't think we're going to see the sun again for another 2 weeks. So anyway, I don't expect to see any of those.
But what's so frustrating is we get all this rain, and you know, as sure as night follows day, in a couple of weeks' time, there'll be warning of water shortages. And saying, well, what happened to all this rain that we've had? And
that's
the water
true.
Companies are leaking water Can you leak water hand over fist? I think I've got the wrong metaphor there. But
I don't know. Maybe you can if you're that little boy with his finger in the dike. I don't know.
But there's a piece on the BBC website that came on today. The figure of across England and Wales, about 3 billion litres of water, or 660 million gallons, or as they prefer to put it on the BBC website, 1,180 Olympic swimming pools.
Olympic swimming pools, yes, of course.
Or double, they're always double-decker buses.
The ISO unit, the ISO unit of water.
Of volume, yes. Yeah. 1,180 Olympic swimming pools of water is lost to leaks every day across England and Wales. And it is an extraordinary amount. And in a way, although it's appalling, it's sort of, it's a bit like Venice. Excuse me, you know, Venice is such a wonderful place, but it's falling apart because it's so old and wonderful. And so much of Britain is falling apart because it's so old and wonderful. you know, it's not all just been, it's not like Dubai, it's been built in the past 10 years, or Qatar, it's been built in the past five minutes. It's all this beautiful Victorian infrastructure, but it's
literally leaking. Well, that isn't anything new. And of course, there are two sides to this coin, because we've got the billions of litres being just soaking into the earth out of our water supply all the time, which of course is pretty bad. But then you've got this flash flooding that we've seen, you know, here in Devon over the last week or so, which again, the problem is water soaking away, only it's not soaking away. And so we have, the sustainable urban drainage systems, which are very popular at the moment, and of course becoming increasingly important to cope with flash floods. Clearly there's some way to go as far as that's concerned, because we still get the flooding, and it's every year now we get a biblical flood somewhere in the country, and we're just really running to catch up, aren't we?
You mentioned SUDS, sustainable urban drainage systems.
Yeah.
A big part of the problem is that so many people have created off-street parking by paving or concreting or tarmacking that patch of
But their front garden,
their,
yeah.
Yeah, it used to be a front garden, a flower bed or a lawn or something. And I don't know, it'd be interesting. I haven't actually, it's always sort of said as anecdotal. I've never actually seen a figure that says exactly how many front gardens have been paved over in the past 20 years.
Well, somebody will have that figure.
What the impact of that is.
Yeah, I don't know. But it is this problem of hard landscaping covering over erstwhile porous ground. And of course, the water has to go somewhere. It can't soak into the ground where it sort of gradually dissipates into the watercourses. It has to go straight into a ditch or a stream or a drain. And then all of a sudden, you've got a huge volume of water flowing down into the main sewer. And of course, this is what Thames Tideway is all about. After all, it's these huge intermittent discharges that you get from sudden flooding. And so they're spending billions of pounds in London to try and cope with this. And millions, certainly, in other parts of the country, and also to try and cope with it. But as I say, we seem to be fighting a losing battle. I don't know whether or not we're actually gaining any ground. But local news seems to suggest that we're not.
On the subject of Thames Tideway, we haven't really talked about that particularly, I don't think, very much in our podcast. But it seems
no,
to
we
be
haven't,
a project
actually.
That is going rather well. I haven't visited any sites on the project.
No, I haven't.
Underground down there. But my impression is it's all going, I was going to say, going swimmingly, going very well.
But yeah, course, I think it probably
Crossrail,
is. But
well, the Crossrail went very well. While
this is exactly what I was going to say.
While it was a tunnelling project.
Yeah.
And while there are process element to Tideway, it is largely...
It doesn't have the same signalling, does it?
Exactly. It's not... It's the computers. Computer says no on Crossrail, and all the signalling and the complicated IT stuff that's brought Crossrail a crop, as I understand it.
Well, Tideway, I suppose we ought to be fairly careful about, but it does the only news I've heard of it, and I haven't heard much news about it at all. It seems to be slowly getting on with business. And in fact, I know that the project hasn't really been delayed by the COVID outbreak. It seems to be continuing on more or less on schedule, unless I'm mistaken. So, yeah, I imagine it's so far a success story. We shouldn't count our chickens, of course. So
Crossrail.
Yes, probably.
Bloody Bishop and Taylor, shut up.
Anyway, so what news have we got this week, Phil? I think it is a fairly slow news week, isn't it? There's not an awful lot of stuff happening that we haven't discussed already in the podcast.
Well, there's not too much that's got me excited, except you might remember we talked about, talking of Thames Tideway, Andy Mitchell, the chief executive of that organisation that's building it. He's also the co-chairman, the industry side chairman of the Construction Leadership Council. And we mentioned a few weeks ago, last month or so, that he had written this letter to Alok Sharma, the business secretary, basically setting out Brexit concerns, that the various things which had yet to, the construction industry is concerned that we'd yet to be prepared for, like standardisation and access to migrant labour is still not completely settled to the construction industry's liking. And tariffs was the third point. And anyway, his organisation, the Construction Leadership Council, set up a Brexit committee, a Brexit working group, rather. They call them all working groups. I don't know who's on that yet. A chap from the National Builders Federation, one of those organisations.
Oh, yes.
Is sort of coordinating it. But it just seems, I don't know if it's an indictment of government or an indictment of the construction industry, that 7 months after we leave the European Union, we set up a group to look into it.
Oh, well, better late than never, I suppose.
Ordinarily, the horse would have bolted, but the horse, we cannot drag it out the stable. So it's still there.
No, that's true. Oh, well. Well, anyway, Phil, I want to talk about my magazine, because that's news. It's just out.
My copy landed on my doormat this week, yesterday, I think it was. And
good.
Diverse array of articles.
Yeah, I think we've got a good mix, actually, in here. I don't know if there are any particular articles that particularly caught your attention. We've got one or two interesting jobs in here. What did you notice?
Well, three that I thought, that I have questions to ask you about and thought were interesting and for various reasons. And just moving from the front of the magazine towards the back, quite towards the front, each issue of the magazine, you focus on a particular sector of the industry, whether it's ground engineering or plant hair or whatever, and you crunch the numbers of the top 20 specialists in that group and see how they're doing compared to last year.
Yeah.
And in this month's issue, it's fit out. I have a slight. I know what piling contractors do. I know what plant hire companies do. Fit out seems to me it's everything from really quite heavy construction to joiners and just putting up shelves or lampshades or something, isn't it? I mean, it spans a wide area. But
it's interiors and fit out. I always think of it as those two things. It's not exactly interior decorating, because there is some decorating involved, but it's a bit more structural than that, isn't it? It's actually shaping the internal environment, and of course its manifestation depends to a large degree on what that interior space is, because of course in an office it's going to be quite different from a hospital, for example, but you still get fit out in a hospital. Tends not to be the clever systems. I mean, that's the M&E, but it's still things like partitioning and lighting, flooring, that kind of thing. Quite, you know, important stuff. It's the stuff that actually creates the environment that people are actually living and working in.
It's the stuff people care about, to be honest. If you're sitting inside an office building for 8 hours a day, you probably don't care too much what the outside looks like, because you don't have to look at it, although you might be ashamed to be in something particularly grotty. Proud to sit in, you know, proud to work in some palace or whatever. But as you say, essentially, what's most important to you is are you comfortable and happy in your day-to-day environment?
Exactly. Yeah, it's an important sector of the industry. It doesn't seem to be doing particularly well at the moment.
This is even before your numbers. I think almost all of them are pre-COVID numbers, aren't they? The 2019
numbers. Yeah, we're talking about Sorry, we're talking about the financial year typically ending December last year. I mean, there are some older. I mean, there's Modus Workspace. The latest figures are for the for 2018. But we're talking 2018, 2019. So none of this takes into account the effects of COVID-19. And a lot of the companies involved in their annual reports and financial statements, which has become a feature of their annual statements for the last few years. They talk about Brexit a lot, and of course this has been the big unknown and the big worry for them. And it's also been perhaps a bit of a scapegoat for some of them to blame their less successful figures actually on the uncertainty created by Brexit. Well, that's still the case here.
I'm going to take you up. I'm going to pull you back on that. I think
for the
fit-out sector particularly, a lot of their big clients are, or a lot of the big prestige jobs are big banks in big cities and so on. And there has been an awful lot of pause button pushing.
Yes, that's true.
Around Brexit. I'm not sure how much cancellation there's been, but there's an awful lot of investment was just paused for a while, which did cause a lot of trouble for these companies who are all set expecting this job to go ahead.
Yes, that's true. Yes. I'm sure they're not. People would see through it immediately if they were just trying to hide behind the Brexit problem. But I think some of them talk it up a little bit too much. But anyway, the fact is that things have slowed down quite a lot for the fit out sector, not necessarily in terms of the actual flow of work, because, I mean, although there has been a 4% decrease in turnover, sort of total turnover figure for this selection of 20 fit out firms, it's profitability that seems to have suffered most. And there's actually been a 14.3% fall in overall pre-tax profits here. So they're still working hard, but they don't seem to be producing as much.
Well, I think some devil's in the detail here, because you I'm looking at the table you produce, and indeed the 20 firms on the list have turned over between them 4% more than the last time, 12 months ago, when we looked at their numbers. But what you also report in the article is that we've lost three big hitters from that top 20.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So if those companies have been lost, their turnover's gone from, let's say, 50 million to zero. You've got some big drops there which aren't included in your table because they no longer appear in the table.
Yes. Well, that is quite true. And of course, what that's done has made created three spaces which have been taken by smaller firms that have found themselves nudging into the top. Yeah, it is actually. Yes, absolutely it is. But of course,
the
fact is
that for promotion.
But of course, the fact is that one of the three firms that went under last year was Stiles & Wood, which was a very big one. It was about third or fourth on the table last year. And that's created a space on the table, which has been taken by somebody coming in right at the bottom with a much smaller turnover figure.
Yes.
So that's part of the effect, I suppose.
So Claremont Group at the bottom of your table, they grew by 5 million in turnover, which is I beg your pardon, they didn't, they shrank. But let's look at above.
Yes, they did.
Jason Group, who grew by 4%.
Yes.
From 46 point something to 47 point something. I'm reading the wrong line there.
No, you're looking at Wagstaff Brothers.
I am. 37 to 39, roughly.
Yes.
They've added 2 million. But that adding on 2 million in the grand scheme of things is nothing compared to Stiles & Wood's several hundred million, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember. I'm just trying to have a look. No, I can't remember what Stiles & Wood's figure was for last year. I have got it. I have got it here, actually.
But it must have been. It must. I'm guessing it was three figures of millions.
It was last year in our look at the fit out sector. Stiles & Wood had a turnover of 151.5 million, and that was up from 100 million the year before. So they contributed a lot, actually, to the overall turnover figure.
The other thing I thought was interesting about the looking at the fit-out sector, is naturally there is the instinctive, the headline to look at is say their profits are down, they're having a hard time, Brexit's been difficult for them, and now there's COVID, and this is all lots of uncertainty. and who's going to be working in offices anyway? What fit outs are going to be, and what's going to go on? But on the flip side of that, a lot of these guys I reckon have been busier than anyone during COVID, reconfiguring, putting up partitions in banks and supermarkets and offices. And I mean, partitions is the business to be in at the moment, I think.
Well, it is. Yes, the Perspex business, actually. Every retail outlet I go into now has Perspex screens. So, I think, you know, they say it's an ill wind that blows nobody any good. It's a bit of a mixed bag for the fit-out sector because, yes, maybe a lot of their clients will think, oh, well, I'm not going to invest in a nice smart office now because, you know, 50% of the people I was going to populate it with are going to be working from home. But
remember our guest last week, Kevin Lyons was saying that schools are immediately not fit for purpose. The ones we're building right now, these schools are probably not fit for purpose. And that's equally true in the post-COVID world. If it's as life-changing and all-encompassing as it appears to be at the moment, most offices will have to be refitted out, I guess.
Yes,
I
guess so.
Boom time for fit out. Maybe that's, you know, next month's article on.
Well, we'll find out this time next year when we revisit this sector again. Next month, next month we won't have a sector focus, and because next month we're doing our top 100, our annual review of the top 100 building and civil engineering contractors. It will be interesting. Yeah. I'm putting it together now. Actually, it's all been compiled, and a lot of the companies actually have something to say about COVID in this month's issue. So that will be interesting.
While you're working on that, putting it all together, all those numbers together, you've got the latest results from company X, Y, Z.
Yes.
And then as soon as you put, you know, you blow dry the ink or whatever, they report the latest figures, newer figures.
That's right. We get their half year figures in about June. So, yes. So it gives you
a move it target.
Yes, you are. It gives you a flavour of what might be coming. But obviously what we produce is a snapshot based on their latest financial results.
It's a shame they don't all have the same financial year, I think. It would be.
Yeah, exactly. It tends to blur the picture, but that's unavoidable. Yeah. So that'll be worth talking about next month because there's some interesting information coming out of that. So that's sector focus. And there's another feature in here, which I rather enjoyed putting together. I didn't put it together, actually. I commissioned somebody to write it. It's something we rarely do, which is an international story. We have a stringer, a journalist who writes for us occasionally, based in Moscow, a chap called Eugene Gurdon. He is Russian. He's an international journalist. He writes for a number of business publications in the UK and elsewhere in Europe as well. And he's written us an article about the construction market in Russia, which, you know, don't all rush because... You know, apparently Mr. Putin is quite keen to encourage UK and other... Are those your dogs in the background, Phil?
I'm sorry. Henry's just had his dinner and now he wants playtime.
Oh, dear. All right, then.
Hopefully he'll find a toy and...
Yeah, OK. All right, then. No problem. As I was saying, yes, Vladimir Putin apparently is quite keen to encourage investment and the contribution of construction expertise from Western specialists. And so he's, I wouldn't say a charm offensive is the term to use.
It's not clear to me. Do they want Western expertise or Western money?
I think my feeling is that reading between the lines, it's the Western money that they want. They want the inward investment. But they seem to be keen on getting contractors from the West to come in. I don't know, because obviously they're not going to be investing. They will have obviously a supply chain. But I should imagine any Western contractor going into Russia will come with a supply chain. They won't procure everything in Russia unless the Russian government actually requires them to do so. But yeah, I don't know if you remember, but Boris Johnson had a nice friendly chat with Vladimir Putin back in May on the occasion of the 75th VE Day celebrations. And they said all the fairly predictable stuff about how, you know, weren't we great at smashing the Nazi threat and all the rest of it, and saying we need to work a little bit harder on bilateral relations, and you know, all this silly business about overseas assassinations and economic retaliation, all that sort of stuff, ought to stop. Well, apparently that's part of the narrative that Putin would quite like British contractors to go over there and start building things for him. And he's thinking mainly in terms of infrastructure, so port developments and bridges, roads and rail and that kind of thing. But of course, the Russian market, like everyone else, is suffering from the effects of COVID-19. And they're expecting, I mean, there was an organization called Global Data had predicted a 2.6% growth in the construction market in Russia this year, and that's been replaced with a 3.8% decline. So, you know, it's not as if there's everything to sort of play for there. It's still struggling as a market. But it'll be interesting to see whether or not any of the British contractors feel brave enough to go out there and try their hand in the Russian market.
British construction contractors these days seem remarkably shy of taking any sort of risk overseas. They're doing as much as they can to avoid taking any risks at home, never mind overseas. And Eugene's article mentions Keller. I mean, Keller are everywhere. They're a specialist, ground engineering specialist.
Yes, of course.
A global force. That sort of a company. It may be an RMD quick form or someone with a particular specialism who is active on the international stage. You might get some of those in there. But on the whole, it seems to be our consulting engineers will travel the world and take on projects all over the place. But we don't have many. I'm thinking of a company like the Dutch company, Mammut, and they came into my mind because the big picture in the magazine and the Russian feature articles of the Crimean bridge, controversial bridge, has got lots of strand jacks lifting it up, and that's the sort of thing, that specialist heavy lifting, jacking up a bridge like that.
Yeah, that's very international.
There
yes,
aren't
quite
many
right.
companies that can do that, and those that do that, those sort of niche specialisms, do tend to go wherever they're requested and earn a good margin for doing it. And I think, apart from Keller, I struggle to think of many British construction companies who are contractors and have world-beating, go-anywhere, do-anything niche. Hmm. I mean, I'm sure there are small ones, but very specialist ones. But we don't seem to have many.
But Balfour Beatty, I mean, they work overseas, but they tend to work in joint venture, don't they, with other people?
Well,
they're quite big in the States, of course.
They're big in the States. They've got Gammon in Hong Kong, which is a giant Madison joint venture. I don't know how much. I don't know how much say Balfour Beatty has in what goes on at Gammon, or whether Gammon's just successfully. I mean, I think of it as very much a Hong Kong company, even though Balfour Beatty happens to own half of it. So I don't know how much travel or movement of thoughts and people and equipment there is between Gammon and Balfour Beatty.
No.
I mean, they used to have Ductco in the... I don't know if they've still got Ductco in Dubai, Balfour Beatty Ductco. I'm not sure if they've still got that or not.
Oh, right, OK. No, I haven't heard of them for a long time. But I too doubt that Mr. Putin's blandishments are going to lure any British contractors over to Russia anytime soon. For a start, I think that international relations have to take a considerable turn for the better before anybody considers doing that. And in fact, Eugene in this article does acknowledge that there are questions of government interference, corruption, local protectionism, that kind of thing, that really will make it very difficult for anybody who wants to go over and work in that market.
I think you've got to be start staring mad, frankly, to take on a job in Russia. I think China would be a safer bet, and that's a political risk. And that's saying something.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Russia. A bit closer to home. Battersea. What did you read that article about?
I did. Well, the picture at the top of the page, the cross section of the most interesting structure, and it clearly looks like a university building the way it's laid out. This cross section, and it's a CGI building rather than us impression. And I would love to have next to it a similar image of the finished building when it's done. Obviously, it's not finished yet. We should tell people where it is. But see whether it really looks quite as magnificent as the CGI. Tell us about this project.
Yeah, well, sorry, I was going to talk about Battersea, but you're talking about Warwick University,
which is
this is also an interesting story. This, I have to say, and I'm not a civil engineer, was a difficult article to write because it's very technical, but it's very interesting. Warwick University, their arts faculty, they're very proud of it. They're supposed to be one of the 50 best arts faculties in the world, somebody said. I don't know who decides that. But anyway, Warwick University is a highly respected university with a great arts faculty, and they want a nice sparkling building to house everything in, which they're getting. It's currently under construction. It's being built by Balmer and Kirkland. It's a very complicated building designed by the architects Field and Clegg Bradley Studios. Basically, if you were to look, you're looking at this cross-section, which I agree is a really interesting CGI. There are other views, which we didn't have space to include in the article, which show the sort of plan of the building. It's basically in four wings, like four cubes almost, but they're not aligned exactly. They're all funny angles to each other. And inside, there are loads of different levels and they intersect in different ways. Right in the centre of the building, each wing has its own core, and the cores are sort of joined together for stability and structural strength and all the rest of it. And in the middle is this crisscross of suspended bridges, walkways, stairways, that kind of thing. And it was designed to be built a combination of reinforced concrete slabs, beams and columns with some very big fabricated steel beams in the lower parts as sort of transfer beams to basically carry heavy loads across wide spans and, you know, convey the loads down into the foundations. Well, the contractor, once they got on board, had a look at it. And of course, this was the concept design. And clearly there were some issues with how easy this was to build and how, more importantly, how easy it might be to actually realise the architect's vision. And they decided they could do it better if they used post-tension concrete instead of reinforced concrete floor slabs, which meant that they could actually make the slabs thinner, lighter, without sacrificing any strength. And also these huge steel beams, some of them were, you know, a couple of meters deep. To get rid of those and replace those with post-tension concrete beams. So they brought in a specialist firm called CCL, Leeds-based firm. The concrete contractor, I should say, was Whelan and Grant. They brought in CCL to do the development for the post-tensioned concrete. And nearly the entire structure was remodeled to use post-tensioned concrete. And it's had several knock-on effects. Some of the advantages are quite considerable. For example, they no longer need all this fabricated steelwork. So that's basically one trade completely eliminated from the project. That simplifies things.
What this all goes to show, it seems to me, is that the benefit of having contractors involved in the design process. Now, I've said before, I have reservations about the whole drive down the design and build road where the contractor is responsible for everything and we don't have an independent resident engineer or independent architect or client's representative who is checking everything. Too many problems have emerged from giving contractors the power to police themselves, design it, build it yourself, get on with it and just send us the bill. But obviously, it makes absolute sense, and here's the proof of it, for designers to talk to contractors and say, this is what we're thinking of doing, this is a plan, let's have your comments.
Yeah. No, I think this is a really good example of that, actually, because, as you say, very often, what's often called value engineering is obviously a cost-saving exercise, essentially. But it doesn't have to be just about saving cost. You can actually, by substituting something else for the original specification, you can achieve something actually better. And here, what it's enabled them to do is actually get a better result for the architect. You know, obviously the architects like to produce impressive designs, and they don't like them to be compromised in any way. This has actually enhanced the design. It's actually enabled the design to achieve what Field and Clegg wanted, which I think is a really good example of teamwork and contractor involvement at an early stage. So yeah, they're still, I think actually CCL have just about finished their work on site. The structural frame is basically up and completed, and the project obviously is far from complete. I think it's due for completion in time for the 2021-22 academic year, and I'm told that actually that they are on track for that despite the disruption of COVID. They have actually managed to keep on track. So yeah, it looks like a, again, we shouldn't count our chickens, but I think it's on track to be a successful project, and it should be a really impressive building when it's finished.
There's one other article which I thoroughly enjoyed reading. I confess I'd never heard of the man. You put it under the generic heading of brickwork and scaffolding, which is not something you often put together again, put together in a...
No.
But this is what this guy... Lee Marley, who you met, has done. He's a bricklayer. He's set up, well, originally a bricklayer. He's a bricklaying big boss now. Who set up a scaffolding division. He's a bricklayer for Eton College and Belmarsh. Was it Belmarsh Prison or Brixton Prison?
But yeah,
it's quite a Belmarsh. Belmarsh to Eton is his portfolio,
A few other projects in between as well. I have to say,
and I believe those two institutions have. Similar, actually, I think Belmarsh is more expensive than Eton to attend, but has better food.
Probably.
Tell me about Lee Marley. He sounds an interesting guy.
Well, he is. He started off in my neck of the woods. He was born in London, and he moved down to Barnstaple when he was very young. Went to North Devon College and did a brickwork apprenticeship. And like a lot of young aspiring and ambitious tradesman, decided he was going to work for himself. He did start off working for a local firm, and then he decided he could do better just by setting himself up as a one-man band, which he did. But he couldn't help himself. He kept finding work which was too much for him to do on his own, so he was subcontracting it out to his friends. They were all self-employed, of course. You know, they weren't employees. And he did really well, and he had a good head on his shoulders. He had a good head for business. And he decided that North Devon was too small for him. So he decided to go back to the capital and started working on quite a big job. I don't know what it was, but he was working for a big brickwork subcontractor. Well, anyway, a brickwork subcontractor. I don't know how big it was. But unfortunately, it went bust not long after he'd started there. And instead of saying, oh, bugger that, and trying to find himself another job with a different subcontractor, he decided this job that we're working on is too good to miss. I'll take it on. And that's where he started to actually build up his own business as a subcontractor.
I can't remember what it says in the article, but he was like 20-something years. I mean, he was a whippersnapper at this stage, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He was. Apparently, he reckons that his business, he was earning £60 a day on this job in London. And he was only in his early 20s. And I think he was actually 20 at the time. And it wasn't enough. He said it wasn't enough to live on. So when this subcontractor went down, he decided to take the job on, started his own business. And within 5 years, business was worth £5 million a year, so he was doing really well. So he set up a.
So he's 20 years old when the company he's working for goes bust. So he goes to the client and says, "Sod them, I'll get this sorted for you." And the client goes, "Yeah, you're the sort of chap, you know, can do bloke we need, do it." And that is just
exactly.
That's a great story.
It is. I mean, he was, as I say, earning £60 a day. And then he stepped into the shoes of this defunct subcontractor. Within a year, he'd turned over £1 million And 4 years later, he was turning over 5 million. And, you know, he hasn't looked back. He's now one of the biggest brickwork subcontractors, certainly in the southeast. And he doesn't confine himself to the southeast either. He works all over the place. Recently opened up in Scotland. He's got a big job with Lang O'Rourke in Edinburgh at the moment.
But that's not the story, is it? The brickwork is not the story.
No, it isn't really, because the interesting thing was that he noticed that, because he does a lot of work with house builders, there's a lot of bricklaying, of course, in house building. Some of his biggest clients are major house builders. And he said one of the biggest problems on a house building site is that the bricklayers are always hanging around waiting for the scaffolding. And he said the biggest, the biggest cause of dispute and aggro on site is between the bricklayers and the scaffolders.
Certainly
that was his experience. Well, exactly. Or the bricklayers are waiting to get up to the first story level and the scaffolding isn't there, so they can't do it.
Or the scaffolding's in the way and they can't raise the height of the bricks.
So they're just up against each other all the time. And so he decided, well, look, if I provided my own scaffolding, this would make things a lot easier because we'd be in control. So he noticed that the scaffolding firm was going under and he bought it out and started doing that. And he found that his clients loved it because it gave him what he calls a one-stop shop. You know, they would take him on, he'd do the scaffolding, he'd do the bricklaying, there was no hold-up on site, and everything was nice and smooth. You know, it was easy, it was simple. And he carried on doing this. It seemed to work really well. He did find out very early on one of the reasons why a lot of bricklayers don't do scaffolding, and that's because scaffolding is an expensive business to get into. I wasn't aware that... I mean, scaffolding is just galvanized steel tubes, clamps and wooden boards, but this stuff, a lot of it actually goes missing a lot of the time and gets damaged and needs replacing, and it's not cheap.
I thought it would be low barrier to entry for scaffolding, but apparently not.
Well, according to Lee Marley, no, it's not. He reckons that he's spent £10 million on scaffolding equipment since he set his business up, which is basically £1 million a year. But he needed estimators. He needed scaffolding people. He needed designers. He needed more space because, of course, as a scaffolding contractor, you've got a lot of scaffolding which you need to store. So you need a yard. So he had to invest in a larger yard. But he wasn't deterred, and it seemed to be obviously paid off for him, because now his scaffolding business is worth, I think it's £12 million a year, growing fast. He's now reaching the end of a very large contract with Ballymore, the developer Ballymore, on the Embassy Gardens project in Battersea.
That's part of the Embassy area, isn't it? All part of Vauxhall.
That's right. It's a big, very expensive, very posh residential development. Right on the south bank of the Thames by the new American embassy, and it's very fancy. It's got one of the main features of it is this acrylic sky pool, which I'd read about while ago.
Something like a Bond villain would have, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's basically a see-through swimming pool, which links two buildings at about 12 stories up. No, I think it's 10 stories actually. That's quite high enough for me. You wouldn't get me in that swimming pool at all. But it's called a sky pool, and you can swim across and look down 10 stories to the street below.
Actually, it wasn't Bond. It was it was Jason Statham in one of his films where he
oh really
shoots up the side of a skyscraper and drills a hole or something in the bottom of this guy's swimming pool that he has to kill, and then it cracks, the whole swimming pool just collapses, and it's cantilevered thing. I don't know if it's the same structure as this Ballymore one, but it's very, very glossy and OTT.
Oh right, okay. Well, that's bad publicity for Ballymore, isn't it? But but anyway, this sky pool, obviously the sky pool. I was going to say it hasn't got anything to do with Lee Marley, but that's not true actually, because they did the scaffolding while it was being installed, and of course it's quite complicated scaffolding. There were some ground support issues around the base of this development. There were storm drains which wouldn't support the weight of the scaffolding, so they had to design a scaffold structure that cantilevered out at, I think, a couple of, certainly at first floor level, and I think then again up at 10th floor level to to support the scaffold on the outside. He might be a bricklayer, but he's also a very capable scaffolding contractor. And he says that he now regularly comes up against the four largest scaffolding contractors in the country when he's bidding for work. The reason he spoke to me was that he's decided he's going to push scaffolding. It's going to be one of the things that he's going to try and grow over the next year. He's doing well. He's got...
What's the company called?
It's called Lee Marley. Lee Marley Brickwork. I imagine that Lee Marley Scaffolding is what he calls a scaffolding division. Yeah, Lee Marley Brickwork. He's based in London. No, he's not based in London. He's based in Reading now. He's had to move out of London. Reading's quite a good place to be, actually, for a company that doesn't confine itself to London, because, you know, he's right on the M4 and he can get anywhere he likes quite quickly. Yeah, so he's doing well, and it's quite interesting. He came up against quite a lot of resistance in the industry for combining brickwork with scaffolding. People said it just wasn't cricket, you know, and people didn't like him doing it. But he took no notice, and he's made a success of it. So yeah, and we should say that the brickwork also at Embassy Gardens is itself very impressive. I mean, it's unusual in a project like this in that there's a lot of brickwork. Most of the facades are brick, and I think he's used about 100 different types of brick finish, bonding, that kind of thing. The signature piece, which is underneath the sky pool and also I think wraps around the building, is green glazed brick, and there's a lot of that. That's quite impressive. So yeah, he's a skillful bricklayer and a successful businessman.
Good stuff. Well, David, we've been talking for a long time now.
And I think we have.
We've probably had entertained people for long enough once again. Should we call it a day?
I think that's a good idea, Phil. Yes. So, I think that we've bored people long enough, or entertained them long enough. Sorry, the faux pas.
I hope we're still entertaining people. And if you have been entertained, you can subscribe to this podcast, Reconstruction, at all the usual podcast outlets. My name is Phil Bishop. I've been talking with David Taylor, and we will be back again the same time next week. Speak to you then. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith, an independent newsagent UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.